A year ago today, the army in Myanmar seized power in a coup. Peaceful counter-protests were met with bullets. And now the opposition has given up on nonviolence.
They realize that armed resistance is the only option left.
We take you inside that resistance with an engineer who's become a bomb maker. I'm Marco Werman. Also on today's show, the Winter Olympics start this week. Athletes who've successfully dodged COVID are now starting to arrive in Beijing.
It finally feels like we can breathe and say, okay, we're here.
And she knew her mother was a good singer, but a rock and roll star with hits back in Vietnam? That prompted a lot of questions.
When did you record this? How many songs did you record? And where are the records?
We've got the answers today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you with us. 1 year ago, on this day in Myanmar, the military staged a coup and took over the country. The army locked up elected officials, including Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar's leading politician. When people protested in the streets, soldiers gunned them down. In the last year, about 1,500 civilians have been killed. At this point in the conflict, many in Myanmar are done with nonviolent resistance, and former protesters are taking part in military training, ready to fight. The World's Patrick Nguyen, along with co-reporter Mong Mo, are bringing us an inside look at what's become a civil war of people taking on the army in Myanmar with whatever they've got, from homemade rifles to dynamite. Just a note, Mong Mo is a journalist from Myanmar who works under a professional name, not his legal name. That's because reporting on the military is extremely dangerous. The story also contains descriptions of violence. Here's Patrick.
Atu was never a tough guy. More of a Gen Z bookworm. Loved school, loved making things, so he went to college to become an engineer. And he did. He scored a great job in Yangon, Myanmar's largest city. Atu became a workaholic. If you saw him a year ago, you'd see this skinny, stressed-out guy in front of a laptop. He says, I was single. I barely ever saw my buddies. That was life before the coup. Before the military turned his city into a war zone. Before his company shut down and he lost his job, lost his dream, and decided to fight back. Atu's resistance started off pretty tame. Beating pots and pans by his window at night. In the early days after the coup, that's how people would defy the military. But then Atu thought, is this it? The army murders protesters with machine guns and we just bang on pots? So he got some friends together to go to a local district office and burn it down. It was nighttime, Atu says, and they were walking towards the building. He whispered to two of his buddies, get away from the streetlight. Stay in the shadows. Then two loud gunshots. Both friends dropped to the pavement, picked off by an army sniper hiding in a nearby tower. The two men were rushed to the hospital. One died. The other survived but lost a leg. Atu says he wanted revenge, so he and his friends went back to stake out that tower. When the sniper finally climbed down, Atu says, we pounced on him with swords. The guy fired his gun wildly, but this time he missed. They got him to the ground and finished him off. Atu had killed someone, a soldier, and now there was no turning back. The story of how Atu ended up here, it doesn't begin with the coup. It really goes back at least 10 years, when he was a kid. His parents and grandparents, all they'd ever known was totalitarian army rule in Myanmar. But Atu's generation was different. They were promised elections and free speech. Everyone was saying this. In 2012, the American president flew to Myanmar and staked his reputation on it.
There will be those who resist the forces of change. But I stand here with confidence that something is happening in this country that cannot be reversed.
Obama lifted U.S. sanctions, and Myanmar's military did step back. There were elections, and better jobs, and cell phones, and Facebook. And sure, the army was still tormenting minorities deep in the jungle, but in the cities, life got better. Until February 1 of last year, when the army generals changed their mind and shredded everything promised to the urban millennials and Gen Z. Here is my co-reporter, Mong Mo.
They were all so angry that Myanmar military has organized another coup when the country is speeding up to get more development, a lot of better things to have in the future.
Since the coup, the economy has collapsed, and people go to prison left and right just for looking at the wrong post on social media. Mong Mo says this generation has decided enough is enough. They can't peace march their way out of this nightmare.
They realize that armed resistance is the only option left to defeat this military.
In cities and towns, people are rising up, the middle class and the poor, mechanics and factory workers, software developers and bank tellers. But Mong Mo points out one major challenge.
Like 95% of them wouldn't even know how to shoot a gun before, you know. So everything is very new for them.
Who does know about guns in Myanmar? Ethnic minorities in the country's mountains who've been fending off the military for decades. Tens of thousands of city dwellers, men and women, have now fled to the jungles, asking indigenous fighters, please, teach us how to shoot back. That's exactly what Atu did. After killing that sniper, he ran off to the jungle, gave himself a revolutionary name, Atu. And soon, a guerrilla commander was putting an M16 in his trembling hands. I was sweating and shaking, he says. But he told himself, you need to not be afraid of this gun. Stop thinking this is weird. That guerrilla commander had a picture of Myanmar's military dictator, Min Aung Hlaing, and he nailed it to a distant target. And he said to Atu and the other trainees, whoever can shoot that gets extra potatoes for dinner. We also learned how to shoot heavy guns, he says. I thought they would be too heavy for the girls, Atu says, but the commander told him, you're going to have to do push-ups too if you want to carry a gun that big. Honestly, Atu realized he just isn't a commando. He's an engineer. So with some help from the guerrilla fighters, he's now back to doing what he's good at, building things, like homemade bombs. This recent video shows an IED planted by a resistance fighter in Myanmar blowing up an army truck. That bomb was not the handiwork of Atu, but he has been working with this new wave of urban revolutionaries, folks who've gotten jungle training and are now back in the cities. He talks to them over encrypted chat, designing bombs for them, telling them where to place them. In downtown Yangon, there is this giant golden pagoda, shaped like a Hershey's Kiss, Sule Pagoda. It's on all the postcards. It's also in a heavily defended district. But last September, near the pagoda, a bomb erupted at a police station. Atu says that one was one of mine. Atu says it's stressful to keep coming up with new missions. He knows his fellow revolutionaries could be caught at any time. These new underground cells call themselves PDFs, People's Defense Forces. They've popped up all over the country. Altogether, they claim to have killed more than 5,000 soldiers and hundreds of government officials. Atu says this army dictator, Min Aung Hlaing, is obsessed with power, and he doesn't deserve to face peaceful resistance. So far, the U.S. and the U.N., they're not supporting people like Atu. He says Western diplomats are stuck on the old script, where protesters ask for basic rights and get massacred, while the West says their courage is inspiring.
They're marching in the streets. They're raising red balloons and banging pots and pans, and they are demanding their democracy back.
That's Linda Thomas Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., speaking last February.
We stand with the millions of people in Myanmar who have displayed courage and determination to reject this military coup.
She's talking about protesters, not fighters like Atu. To him, words like this just sound hollow. The face of the pro-democracy movement was Aung San Suu Kyi, the country's deposed former leader. But she's in prison and may never get out. Like it or not, the new face of the opposition is someone like Atu, a person who thinks the only path to democracy is by defeating this army. Everyone here wants democracy, like you have in America, Atu says. I'll sacrifice my life for it. But it would be great, he says, if someone gave us more guns. That said, he's not waiting around for handouts. In the months ahead, Attu says he plans to meet with more underground cells and teach them how to make bombs. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen, co-reporting with Mong Mo.
On tomorrow's show, the story of a soldier in Myanmar facing an agonizing choice. Should he continue to do his job and follow orders, or join the resistance? A couple of quick wildlife notes for you before we take a break about animals crossing into the U.S. from the north and south. There's the snowy owl, a migratory bird whose summer home is in the Arctic. And the Mexican gray wolf comes from, well, yeah, Mexico. One Mexican gray wolf in particular has been in the news this winter. His name, Mr. Goodbar. He was born in a breeding program and released into the wild in Arizona 2 years ago.
And he ended up going on a big walkabout, which is not all that unusual for wolves.
That's Michael Robinson from the Center for Biological Diversity. He says Mr. Goodbar wears a GPS collar so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service can follow his progress. It looked like he was headed to Mexico looking for a mate.
But he ended up walking for 5 days along the newly constructed border wall, pacing back and forth.
Couldn't get over it, couldn't get through it, so he went back north, found another group of gray wolves.
But somebody shot him and injured his leg, and it was amputated on Friday.
Upsetting news for sure, but when he heals, Mr. Goodbar is going back to the wild and will again try to find a mate. Thing is, the pickings are pretty slim. There are only a few hundred Mexican gray wolves remaining on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, and they mostly share the same DNA. Okay, next critter. This video showing our other border-crossing animal was taken yesterday on the Jersey Shore. In it, you see a snowy owl. They usually stick to Canada and U.S. border states, but you wouldn't know it from the bird's many appearances this winter far south of the border in the U.S.
As far south as the Outer Banks of North Carolina, southern Tennessee, there was a bird at a Union Station in Washington for a couple of weeks, delighting everybody.
Scott Widensall studies the winter ecology of snowy owls.
About every 4 years, we get a big pulse of snowy owls coming into eastern North America from the Canadian Arctic. And that's because last summer there was a bountiful number of lemmings.
Yep, lemmings. A big year for those little rodents up in the Canadian far north meant an even bigger year for the birds that eat them. But even if the snowy owl is a predator, Widensall says they're still pretty vulnerable.
Many of these snowy owls have never seen human beings before, and they don't have much. They don't have much caution around people.
That means we humans need to be cautious around them. Widensall says that if a snowy owl is paying attention to you, you're probably standing too close. Eventually, COVID-19 will become an endemic disease, and we'll all just be living with it at some point in the future. But here's the thing. The coronavirus is still going to require a serious approach. When will the pandemic become an endemic, and what does that really mean? That story's ahead. You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Ecuador, flooding has triggered landslides in the capital of Quito, killing 18 people. Heavy rains also contributed to a rock slide that ruptured an oil pipeline in Ecuador's Amazon region. Thousands of barrels of oil spilled into two tributaries of the Amazon River. This is one of the largest such disasters Ecuador has seen in recent years. Nearly 30,000 people are likely to feel the impacts. Michael Fox has that story.
The images that have been shared over social media are pretty devastating. In one video, oil pours over a hillside. Complete rupture of the pipeline, says a man off camera. Complete rupture. Look how fast the oil's moving. It's all headed for the river, he says. Downstream, another man films as the torrent of crude spills over an embankment in a thick black waterfall and pours into the Coca River, one of the largest and most important tributaries in the Ecuadorian Amazon. Thousands and thousands of liters of oil, says the man. It's terrifying. It's contaminated the Coca River. My God, he says. In a press release issued hours after the spill, OCP, the private company that built and operates the pipeline, said they had the oil flow under control and were taking all measures to minimize environmental damage. Ecuador's Minister of Energy tweeted that 100 technicians, machinery, and equipment had been sent to the spill site. But downstream, communities are already seeing the impact, even hundreds of miles away. Valerio Grefa is an indigenous Quechua leader who lives along the Coca River in the village of San Pablo. Everything is covered in oil, he says. The river, the surface of the water. Decades ago, this was the cleanest river. Now it's the most contaminated, the deadest river. It's such a shame, he says. This was the second major oil disaster in the Ecuadorian Amazon in just 2 years. The last spilled 16,000 barrels into the Coca River, impacting more than 100 communities. The same people are being hit yet again. Alejandra Almeida is a biologist with the environmental group Acción Ecológica.
Las comunidades en este momento se encuentran en una situación muy, muy grave.
These communities are in a very, very serious situation, she says, because they don't have access to the river water, so they can't fish there and they can't drink from it. Oil contamination from spills and poor cleanup has long plagued Ecuador's Amazonian communities. Cancer rates are higher than normal in many areas. Lawsuits have often languished in the courts. A case is currently pending in Ecuador's Supreme Court over the 2020 oil spill. Conservative President Guillermo Lasso is pushing for more oil production. On the campaign trail in early 2021, he said he wanted to double oil production up to 1 million barrels a day, in part to pay off the country's national debt and shore up the economy. Most of that extraction would come from the oil-rich Amazon region. Human rights groups say that plan has a cost. Brian Parker is a senior attorney with Amazon Frontlines, an NGO that works with local indigenous groups.
The people that are suffering are the people that are living in the Amazon. You know, oil's history in Ecuador is atrocious, but so long as it happens in the Amazon and in indigenous territories far from the city elite, it appears that the government doesn't really seem to care.
Environmentalists say the government and the private oil companies should be taking measures to avoid oil disasters like this. Indigenous leaders are demanding action and threatening another lawsuit if that doesn't happen. We want remediation, they said over the weekend. We want justice. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
India announced today it's planning to launch a new digital currency within the next fiscal year. The digital rupee will be backed by India's central bank in a move the country hopes will boost its digital economy. India is following the lead of neighboring China, which has been experimenting with a digital version of the yuan for the past 2 years. Joining us now to further discuss this is Faisal Khan. He's an independent cryptocurrency researcher and author of an online newsletter, Startup and Econ. First things first, Faisal, why this decision by the Indian government? Was it cryptocurrency popularity like Bitcoin in India that drove it to making a digital rupee?
Yeah, great question. There's definitely been an explosion in popularity in the last year. It's been actually a bit of a contentious issue. Recently, government had tried to ban cryptocurrencies and had banned crypto exchanges. That was then overturned by Supreme Court 2020. And since then, there's been probably like a tenfold increase in usage and investment. But I think it's really mostly about this kind of rivalry with China, as well as India's economic situation. You know, digital payments in general have been a bit of a troubled spot for this government since the demonetization of paper currency 5 years ago. And since then, they've been trying to push digital payments as the future.
So do you kind of see this as a way for India to embrace digital currency with some governmental controls?
I think that's a great way to put it. The cat was out of the bag already, so probably the best thing that they could do was impose the highest tax rate that they have, which is at 30%. I think they were always been probably concerned about capital flight, which is basically money leaving the country to either avoid taxes or currency depreciation. So the best thing they could do was try and discourage it with high taxes.
The hope in Delhi is that the digital rupee will be a boon to the Indian economy. I mean, what could you imagine the impact of this being?
So it'll be really dependent on the scale and the target. So most of the research around central bank digital currencies has been in two different flavors. One that's targeted at banks, that's basically meant to make the banking system more efficient. The other flavor is targeted at kind of your average citizen. If it's on the banking side, you could definitely see some maybe efficiencies gained, but how you roll out a digital currency to over a billion people is definitely going to be a big challenge.
Would it hold the same value as a paper rupee, or would the digital rupee be shielded in some way from fluctuations in the market?
Yeah, so I think this will be run by the Reserve Bank of India. So it's probably going to be as good as a paper rupee, you know, possibly fully backed. It could be that they work with some banks in the country and use reserves, commercial banks, to participate in this pilot and issue the currency or hold it in bank accounts for the end users.
So finally, cryptocurrencies have taken a massive hit in recent weeks, losing much of their value. How can a country like India protect itself if it adopts a digital currency? Or would that not be a problem?
I would imagine it wouldn't be an issue if this was run specifically by the central bank. Now, another point of controversy is non-bank stablecoins or, you know, currency-linked coins. And that's actually been a great point of controversy in the U.S. And whether these should be regulated like banks. And that's going to be probably an open question in India. Once something like a government bank digital currency comes out, people are going to want to do it in the private sector, and they're going to want to make these systems interconnect. And that's going to create all kinds of complications and challenges for regulators to figure out. A centralized cryptocurrency, you know, basically allows the issuer to see every transaction. Being able to conduct transactions in private the way you can with cash is a privacy right. And so giving control to a central government puts that at risk.
Faisal Khan is an independent crypto researcher and author of the online newsletter Startups and Econ, which focuses on crypto and finance. Faisal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Hi, it's Marco. Here at The World, we ended 2021 strong by raising over $86,000 to support the show and this podcast, thanks to you and these listeners. Rima Hyder, Tanya Jones, Christina Skrihat, Ann Schluter, Ali Ali, Carol Boschka, Sherilyn Dunklow, Sharon Fortine, Johnny Hauer, Quentin Cluth. Thanks for your support throughout 2021. We look forward to sharing the news with you for the rest of 2022. In India, weddings can be lavish events that go on for days, but during a pandemic, it's hard to even finalize your guest list.
Till now, I have made it 5 times, revised it 5 times, I would say. And each time, I have had to reduce people, which is not good.
Who do you cut first, friends or family? That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Athletes from across the globe are on their way to China for the 2022 Winter Olympics. They've spent years of grueling training, and this year, athletes have also been subjected to strict COVID protocols in the lead-up to the Games. The world's Bianca Hillier checked in with a few Olympians in the final days before competition starts this week.
Earning a spot at the Olympics is tough, but getting to Beijing is proving to be its own challenge.
It's just been overwhelming.
Nathan Crumpton is a skeleton racer representing American Samoa. He's the first athlete to represent the territory at the Winter Games in 28 years, but he also represented the islands at the Summer Games in Tokyo last year in track and field. Crumpton says this time around, getting to the Olympic Village is even trickier.
Tokyo was certainly stressful in many respects, but this is definitely on an entirely different level in terms of the number of forms that you have to fill out, the COVID protocols that you have to follow. It's really is pretty astounding.
Since the strict COVID measures began last week, less than 3% of athletes, officials, and other stakeholders have tested positive, according to the Beijing Organizing Committee. That's not zero, but the relatively low case count is leaving many athletes feeling pretty good about the situation on the ground. Team USA luge athlete Summer Bricher landed a few days ago. At a press conference yesterday, she said she feels some long-awaited relief.
Still, it's, you know, something could go wrong, but with the daily COVID test and the several we took before coming here, it finally feels like we can breathe and say, okay, we're here, there's lots of precautions in place, and now we can focus on this race coming up.
The races are coming up fast, with curling and luge competitions starting tomorrow. For her part, Great Britain snowboarder Katie Ormerod can't wait to get started.
I'm feeling so excited to be going to my second Olympic Games.
Her second Olympics, but her first time competing. Just days before the 2018 Games, Ormerod suffered a massive fall and shattered her heel. It took her 18 months of rehab to get back on a snowboard. But now, she's looking to grab Britain's first ever snow sport gold medal.
Winning any kind of Olympic medal would mean the world to me. I've pretty much got all the others except an Olympic one, so it would be really nice to add it to the collection, and it feels extra special this time around.
Speaking of snow sports, this year's games have made headlines for using fake snow. Athletes have been worried about how that will work, but since arriving, skiers and snowboarders are saying the conditions are good. Australian mogul skier Brittany Cox told the media she was lucky enough to even get some real snow during practice runs.
I've experienced a lot of different conditions at the Olympic Games. In Vancouver, it was raining. Sochi, it was incredibly icy. Pyeongchang was freezing cold and snowing. So last night, we had fresh snow, and it was really nice to have that.
For other athletes, flying to Beijing for the Olympics is causing a bit of deja vu. Jefferson Sabino made the trip when Beijing hosted the Summer Games in 2008. He represented Brazil in the triple jump. 14 years later, he's on the country's bobsled team.
Foi espetacular o show que Pequim e China deu nos Jogos Olímpicos de organização.
He says Beijing was a spectacular host in 2008, and he expects nothing less this year. Sabino says he's also a more experienced and mature athlete now, and representing Brazil in a winter sport comes with a lot of responsibility.
E até no nosso país, a modalidade não é conhecida, né? Ela passa a ser mais divulgada agora.
He says many people back home don't know much about bobsled, so it's his team's job to take it to the world stage, and they're ready to show people what they're made of. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Denmark today became the first EU country to lift most of its COVID-19 restrictions. The government there says that the coronavirus is still spreading rapidly, but it's not placing a heavy burden on their health system. That's good news for Danes, but there's a lot of concern about other countries that may be opening up too soon. Here's the WHO's head of emergencies, Mike Ryan, at a press conference today.
My greatest fear at the moment is that countries have a lemming syndrome now, and they all chase to open up. And they open up on the basis that the country next door opened up. And the problem is, they don't have the same situation. They don't have the same vaccine coverage. They don't have a strong health system.
Which brings us to the question of when COVID-19 will transition from a pandemic to being endemic. Iris Katsourakis has some thoughts about this. He studies viral evolution and genomics at the University of Oxford. Professor Katsourakis, the word of the day is endemicity, the quality or state of being in an endemic. Break that down to the root, if you would. What does endemic mean?
Endemicity is when effectively the effective reproduction of the virus, its tendency to replicate, is balanced out by the proportion of the population that's immune, creating a stable situation whereby the total number of cases in the community at any time is more or less stable, so neither rising nor falling.
So we're still in the pandemic. I'm just wondering what concerns you about the way the word endemic is being used these days.
Yeah, I think in a lot of people's minds, the word endemic is tied up to this kind of idea of a natural end, that somehow the pandemic will suddenly shift and transition to endemicity without us having to do very much about it. And this assumption is tied in with these optimistic ideas about mildness and a kind of benign coexistence with a virus. And unfortunately, it's not the case that that is an inevitable trajectory. So we may transition to endemicity, some kind of stability. I don't think it's going to happen this year. It'll take some time. But what that endemic future will look like will depend on a lot of things. It'll depend on how much of the population is immune. So have we reached everyone we need to reach through vaccination? And whether we can keep up with the emergence of new variants that might escape to an extent prior exposure or immunity to the virus.
When you hear a country like Denmark has lifted its COVID restrictions, do you think it's the right message for Danes?
Denmark is in a very, very particular situation. It's a country that's really kept on top of the epidemic in a way that few other European countries has. It's probably reasonable to think that Danish hospitals are not about to get overwhelmed through the lifting of restrictions because of this very, very good handling of the situation so far. But it doesn't mean that this lifting is necessarily going to be without any consequence. You're still going to see people infected. There may still be unnecessary deaths. There's always going to be a risk when restrictions are lifted, but Denmark is in a better place to deal with that than many other countries.
So aside from your prediction that it's not going to happen this year, i.e. endemicity, how should we be thinking about the transition from pandemic to endemic?
I think we have to realize that it's a transition that to a large extent we have a big role in managing. So ideally, we vaccinate as much of the world as possible while keeping case numbers as low as possible while we get there until we've really reached the overwhelming majority of the population.
And once endemic is achieved, what safeguards will still need to be in place?
Being able to catch variants that might escape from vaccines, for example, is something that we're going to have to be alert to for many years to come. So genetic surveillance and the ability to follow particular indicators and potentially reintroduce public health measures as things get out of control is something that's going to be part of an endemic future.
Do you have an example of a virus that's endemic but still really deadly?
We can think of measles as being effectively endemic, right? Because we've managed to really restrict its ability to spread through incredible vaccination. But where those vaccination efforts occasionally falter, we see resurgences. We saw that in the USA in 2019, for example, when there was a resurgence in a couple of parts and necessitated some very rapid public health responses. Other viruses we manage through public health. Endemic does not necessarily mean we simply accept that the virus is there. We tend to do everything we can to protect ourselves against it. So, for example, a lot of people bring up the flu. We've got annual vaccination programs. We have surveillance. We try and keep on top of new variants and update our vaccines all the time. We offer the vaccine to kids in schools. You know, endemicity is not necessarily the situation where you just lift your hands from public health measures. It's often a very actively managed situation.
Iris Katsuraki studies viral evolution and genomics at the University of Oxford. Iris, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
10 million weddings. That's how many take place in India each year. The events can be really elaborate and last for days, but since the pandemic, the Indian government has strictly curtailed the scale of weddings there. Today and tomorrow, our correspondent in Mumbai, Chavi Sachdev, looks at what's changed, both for people getting married and for the industry itself. Today, the tale of two brides.
The smallest wedding I've ever attended had 200 guests. And by Indian standards, that's tiny. According to 2019 data, the average number of guests at an Indian wedding is 524, sometimes going up to 2,500 attendees. Who gets invited and who doesn't is always a contentious issue. But since the pandemic started, the Indian government has changed how many people can attend weddings so often, people are getting dizzy. Like 28-year-old physiotherapist Saili Chawan, who's getting married on Saturday.
How many times have you made a guest list?
Till now, I have made it 5 times, revised it 5 times, I would say. And each time I have had to reduce people, which is not good, which I'm not liking.
When she got engaged in early 2021, everyone thought the pandemic was easing up. The government had allowed 200 people at weddings. Then came the terrible second wave. For a time, there were no weddings at all. So they waited.
if it was a normal situation where there was no pandemic, I'm sure they would have invited 300, 400 people.
Just your parents?
Just my parents, 300. And his side, say around 200. So 500 would have been the number of guests at our wedding.
But that's a bit much, she says. 500 includes distant relatives and business associates and everyone whose wedding your parents have ever been to. Finally, in the fall of last year, Mumbai allowed weddings with 200 guests. And she was okay with that. They sent out the invites. Sally and her fiancé had a few months to plan. But actors Gurpreet Bedi and Kapil Arya had almost no time, despite having set their wedding date nearly 2 years ago. Let's rewind to January 2020, before anyone even knew the word COVID.
We saw a lot of venues in 3-4 days and we zeroed in on one. Fell in love with that place instantly. I was like, this is my wedding venue. This is it. And this was in Jan, and March we had the lockdown.
Gurpreet's two sisters live in the UK, and at the time, her mother was visiting them and got stuck. By fall of 2020, they knew they had to postpone.
I'm getting calls from a relative saying, hey, what's happening now? I don't have answers for that. My mom's stuck in the UK for like a year because of the pandemic, and I'm thinking my family can't make it. So that just leaves me and Kapil. So do we just get married like in our living room? That's what we're doing.
One option was to move the wedding to a place like Dubai, where her family could fly in. But then asking her friends to come to a different country, get visas, vaccines, tests, time off.
I was torn between, you know, should I be doing this for my family so they can come, or should I be doing this for my friends so they can come? So I was like losing my mind over this.
They eventually decided they'd just have a courthouse wedding when her mum made it back to India a year later. As soon as the government relaxed travel and quarantine restrictions, Gurpreet and Kapil jumped at it. They booked a venue close to Mumbai, and her family flew in from the UK.
Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Kapil and Gurpreet.
Things just fell into place. I think the guests here were about 200 at the wedding, which still wasn't bad. In 2020, it was 3. So I lost about 100 guests.
And if you'd waited 8 days... you wouldn't have been able to have even that many people.
Correct, because not even 8 days, I think, that the news came out that there are only 20 people allowed at the wedding. And it gave me goosebumps.
Well, 20 is the new cap in Delhi. Back here in Mumbai, physiotherapist and bride-to-be Sayali Chauhan suddenly has to pare her 200 guests down to 50.
It's not at all easy. It's after a lot of planning that we are selecting on people, especially those who are having comorbidities or those who are oldies. We are trying to convince them how it will be good if we don't call them for the function.
Guests are also choosing to opt out. Divya Pal in Bangalore recently tweeted that she's low-key relieved at not having to attend a wedding that got downscaled. She says at first she was excited about attending a wedding after so long, but then started to get increasingly nervous.
The venue was going to be a hotel ballroom, so not very well ventilated, and with eating and drinking, just it kind of got me a bit anxious with the idea of being in that room with so many people.
But that's not the only thing holding her back.
So the idea of pulling on a dress, wearing heels the whole evening, just seemed like a very uncomfortable situation to be in after 2 years of being in such comfortable clothing.
With the new rules, many couples have chosen to postpone their weddings rather than disinvite people. Gurpreet is lucky she got her deposit back on the first venue she'd booked. Most other couples had to forfeit that money. And it's not like smaller weddings cost less. Sayali says that the caterer, decorator, and even the venue are charging the same as before, so it's actually more expensive per head. Again, the guest limit could change by the time Sayali gets married this weekend. She says she has a standby list, but given how offended people are to be disinvited, she doubts they'll now attend. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
To Tomorrow, we'll hear from a caterer and a wedding planner in India. The past 2 years have been brutal, but they're banking that families are ready to cut loose again, big time.
You know, spend more money to show the grandeur. They want that kind of celebration. There is a bit of a peer pressure, and also because people want to celebrate.
That's tomorrow here on The World. Today marks the beginning of the Lunar New Year, celebrated by more than 1 billion people across the globe. That is billion with a B. Typically, it's a holiday that brings family together. For many in the Southeast Asian diaspora, it's also a time to reconnect with heritage and preserve cultural history. This is the story of a mother and daughter who fled Vietnam as refugees nearly 50 years ago. And for them, this New Year really stands out. It's been 2 years since the daughter discovered her mother's secret past, and in that time she's made a concerted effort to track down music believed lost to history. Emily Woodbury has a story from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hana Ha knew her mother was a great singer. Nguyen Thi Tham always steals the show at family karaoke parties.
When I was growing up, that's what I would hear, these Vietnamese songs being belted out on the first floor, and it was so loud, and it was until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
But it was only recently, well into adulthood, that Ha found out her mom had a whole other identity in her youth. When her mom received a letter asking for permission to use her song in a Vietnamese movie, Ha was skeptical. She thought it was a scam. But then, Tham started receiving a lot of Facebook requests. People wanted to connect with the musician who performed the song Magical Night from the film's soundtrack. It turns out the version of Magical Night in the movie is actually misattributed to Tham, but that she did record that song and many others as a teenager. That left Ha with a lot of questions.
When did you record this? How many songs did you record? Who are the composers? And where are the records? Who would know where they are? How do I find them?
Tham was one of very few singers to record Vietnamese rock and roll in the 1960s under the stage name Phuong Tham.
Hannah was just coming to terms with the fact that her mother might have been a teenage rock star with dozens of these recordings to her name.
Mark Gerges is the London-based producer of a 2010 compilation of salvage recordings from pre-war Vietnam. Ha asked him to help uncover her mother's story. And in 2020, they tracked down Tham's recordings, spending countless hours surfing YouTube, sourcing what they could from surviving 7-inch records and reel-to-reel tapes. And now, a year after Ha's discovery and a half century after they were recorded, 25 of Phuong Tham's songs can be heard in the album Magical Nights, Saigon Surf, Twist and Soul. As a teenager in the early 60s, Phuong Tham spent her nights singing for American soldiers, Vietnamese soldiers, and locals.
I sing from 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. I love to sing.
She was in high demand, and she caught the attention of several well-known Vietnamese composers. Between 1964 and 66, she recorded a collection of hits, twist and surf styles, jazz tunes, and early rock songs.
Her legend has been understated for years. Even in present-day knowledge of Vietnam's explosive music scene in the 60s and 70s, her story slipped between the cracks. And I think this has to do with her short-spanning career.
Life happened. Tham got married, started a family. And as the war came to a close, just before the fall of Saigon in 1975, Tham realized she had to leave the country she called home. She feared that her husband could be imprisoned.
He's in Air Force, and if he stay in Saigon, maybe he have to go in jail, you know. That's why I have to go to United States, yeah.
Hanaha was 8 years old when they left. She remembers the day vividly.
We were able to be lifted out in one of the military airplanes out of Vietnam 3 days before April 30th, 1975.
The family had to leave everything behind. They didn't take with them the magazine covers that Phuong Tham graced as a rock star. Piles of vinyl, reel tapes, and cassettes were thrown out, burned, or confiscated by Vietnamese authorities. Tham's music was lost for decades. She never mentioned her singing career to family and friends. She never even heard her own recordings, until now.
When I heard and I cry all the time. Nếu có xa em gì đó.
Nếu có xa nhau.
Nếu có xa nhau. Nếu có xa nhau. Now I want to listen that song all the time.
Like her mom, Ha also left things in Vietnam. She spent her adolescence in the U.S. turning her back on Vietnamese culture. Producing this album has been a way for her to reconnect with her roots.
This is sort of like a gateway to not only music that I turn my back on, but also to the culture that I sometimes was embarrassed, or maybe I thought it was my parents' culture, that I'm Vietnamese-American now, I live in America. So it's really a gateway to finding where I came from.
The album Magical Nights is available digitally and on CD. The vinyl edition will be released in April. Ha is happy to see there's been a global demand for Phuong Tham's music today, particularly in the U.S., Europe, Japan, and Vietnam. She hopes the album serves as a bridge between the people who left Vietnam and those who are still there.
I feel like so much time has passed and so much of the wound has hopefully healed, and music seems to be a healer of those wounds.
Phuong Tham, now 77 years old, gets together weekly with her friends. They spend hours together, sharing food, fellowship, and of course, singing. For The World, I'm Emily Woodbury in St. Louis.
Kiss me, my darling. Be mine tonight. Tomorrow.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. It's now on.